Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Zach Elwood, who writes on Poker Tells. Zach was last on our show in November of 2015, and today returns discussing his new book, Exploiting Poker Tells. We'll be talking to Zach in a few minutes. Beginning January 11th, yesterday, if you pick up the show when it posts, four poker pros are taking on an artificial intelligence bot in Pittsburgh. About a year ago, four pros beat an earlier version of this bot developed by the Carnegie Mellon University over the course of 20,000 hands. This time, the length of the battle will be six times as long, taking place over 3 weeks. The players are in a free roll. If they can pull off the win, they receive $200,000. Last time, I bet Richard a whole $10 that the players could beat the bot. He quickly accepted. I lost and paid up. This year, with 20 months to improve the bot.
Wait, you said that backwards. You said that backwards. You bet on the bot, and I took the players.
That's correct. I did bet on the bot, and I yep. lost. This year, with 20 months to improve the bot, I'm predicting the bot will win. I want to bet against the players, and I'm offering 2-1, my 20 versus your 10. Do you want that bet, Richard?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'll take it again. I think that the machines are coming, but I don't think they're there yet. So, I will happily take the bet. And also, I don't know if the format was the same last time, but they're playing a duplicate style, which means the players will have The computer will play in one room against one player, having the same hand going on in another room where the cards are reversed. So, mm-hmm. Like duplicate bridge works that way, where you're playing the same cards. So I think that's really interesting and should be very telling.
Earlier this week, there's a group in Alberta, Canada, that claimed Heads Up, No Limit Hold'em is now a solved game. And they've proven it against top human competition, although not as top as the four players playing this week. It was written up in Engadget.com, spelled Engadget. And it is the same team that claimed Limit Texas Hold'em Heads Up was solved 2 years ago. This is not the same group as at Carnegie Mellon. I suspect the teams are competing with each other and not collaborating, but that's speculation on my part. Top players believe the day is coming when the bots will beat the players, but basically Richard and I are betting whether that day has happened yet. All right.
Right.
Richard posted an article recently on Twitter and Gambling with an Edge Facebook about an article in an online site called casinos.org and explains how great casino surveillance is. The article makes it sound like whatever players can possibly throw at the casinos are smart enough to detect it and to prevent you from succeeding, except maybe not so much online. Richard, what did you make of that article?
I think anytime you know an awful lot about a subject, when you see that subject in a movie or in the news or whatever, you realize that a lot of reporters just don't do their homework, and they really have no idea what they're talking about. And to me, the article read like this guy just got fed a load of propaganda, and he just ate it up with a spoon, and loved it. They made it sound like the casino was going to catch you when you woke up in the morning even thinking about beating the casino. They were so smart. And I just found the whole thing laughable. I just don't put a lot of credence in what I read or see anymore. I remember when I suffered that kind of loss of illusion about 60 Minutes, which I used to think was just such a great show. And then about 10 years ago, they did a story about internet gambling, and I realized, boy, they just, you know, if their journalism can be that shoddy about what they had to say about a subject they do a lot about, then it made me really skeptical about whatever else they cover. So, anyway, I didn't think much of the article. I found it amusing, actually.
Yeah, I thought I didn't know whether the guy was drinking the Kool-Aid from he talked to a casino surveillance guy, or the manufacturers of some of these various products. There are products out there that companies will sell casinos to prevent a certain kind of cheating, and they have all these fancy lists on their PowerPoint presentations. So it looks like he got that PowerPoint presentation and read off those points as though it was gospel.
Yeah, I also thought it was funny that on the Facebook page, one of the responders was a casino pit boss who said, if this technology is so great, how come every time I call surveillance and ask them about something, they say, oh, we don't quite have the right angle. We can't really see the cards.
Oh, well, let's go on. Let's talk to our guest, Zachary Elwood. Has been playing poker professionally or semi-professionally for more than 11 years. He specializes in reading tells and has just released his third book about it. If you like what you hear today, you may want to check out two interviews with him on this show in October and November of 2015. Zach Elwood, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
How is your new book, Exploiting Poker Tells, similar? And how is it different than your earlier two books?
And I just want to correct first that it's not out yet. It'll be out maybe in another month or so. So say that first. But be out soon, though.
Okay.
And to answer your question, so my first book was Reading Poker Tells, and it was a book about mostly the physical side of the game of poker tells. My second book, Verbal Poker Tells, was focused on, obviously, the verbal things people say at the table. And this one is kind of a more in-depth look at how the practical side of using tells. So it has a lot of hand histories. It goes into hands that I've played and hands that I've observed and talks about, you know, what were the factors in the hand that led to, you know, it being a good idea to base a decision on the tells or the behavior, as opposed to just saying this tell means that or this tell means this. It's an attempt to really break down the factors that can lead to a decision being influenced in a hand, and it can be pretty complex. You know, it's not a lot of poker tells authors or people that write about these things. You know, sort of like your casino security, it's like they paint a very simplistic portrait of it, you know, and I've been a little bit guilty of that too, because it's really hard to write about this stuff in detail. So this is an attempt to really delve into like the details of a hand and talk about like the board texture and a player's past history and how that, you know, how their behavior, you know, ties in with all that stuff.
Does this book supersede your earlier books and combine everything that was in them into one, or is it in addition to, or has your thinking through the couple of years changed on how you look at things, or how does it all fit together?
Yeah, it's more of a trilogy, I'd say, and I don't really plan on doing much more book wise on this stuff. So it's kind of like the completion of the trilogy, because I think a lot of the things from the first two books come into play in this one, but it's I don't go into as much depth as I do on the concepts. So I think that's why I think it's more of a continuation and talking about some of the concepts I talk about in the first two books. And I think my thinking about my understanding of this stuff has gotten a lot better since I wrote my first book. just because I've spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I've also consulted for a couple World Series of Poker final table players, and just really had to, been forced to think a lot more about it. And I think one of the big things I've the big themes I've seen that I read about in this book is the idea that you can break up poker players into two major groups. You can break them up into non-aggressors, people who are checking and calling, or you can break them up into the aggressors, people who are betting. And that's a major way to break it up. And you can see patterns start to emerge when you break the tells up in that way. Like for example, someone who's waiting for someone to act early in a hand acts in very different ways than somebody who's made a bet. Has somebody who's a non-aggressor might have tells of defensiveness, not wanting someone to bet, acting defensive. And that's a very different kind of behavior than someone who's made a big bet and it's either bluffing or comfortable because they're betting a strong hand, and just seeing how those and I've gotten a better understanding as the years have gone on how those things break down and how you can find situational patterns in that kind of thing. So I think that's a big part of what this book is about. It starts out with some of the major concepts as I see them in tells and like the major themes, which I think if you have a good understanding of those, you don't really need to understand every single tell. It's more like understanding the underlying kind of theory behind it, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you mentioned that you'd consulted on a couple of the November 9s for people. So you spent a lot of time studying really pros at the highest levels, whereas your own play is at much smaller levels. Do you find that they're two completely different animals, or do the same principles apply to both those things?
Yeah, I think the same principles apply. It's more just a matter of degree. I mean, the World Series of Poker final table, the main event final table, is just so. Such a unusual event, and especially because you have the players have 3 months to prepare for it before they play the final table. So you're looking at people who most of them are good to start out with. I mean, especially these days, like most of the people who reach that point are professional or professional level, and then you have 3 months to prepare for it. So the people at the final table are very stoic for the most part, especially the last few years. Not so much, 5 years ago or more. It's become much more stoic and serious, in the last few years. And I think it's more just a matter of degree because, it's honestly like hard to find stuff in that kind of game. But if you are able to find stuff, it'll usually just be similar things that you find in smaller stakes games. It's just more subtle. For example, like. One thing I found a few years ago, or at least think I found in the final table in 2013 when I was working that year, was one player that had more hesitation and pauses when he was putting together bets when he was strong versus like when he was weak he would bet more straightforwardly, that kind of pattern, which is a pretty common pattern, like hesitation is more tied to relaxation and strength. But for him, it was pretty subtle. It was just the way, like, he might spend a couple, a second or so, pausing when assembling his chips or something, like little pauses like that. So I think it's more, they're all related. I'd say it's more a matter of degree, yeah.
You mentioned you spent a lot of time, you have 3 months to study, and I would assume you want to get every piece of footage on your opponents you can. Where do you go to get footage on the opponents?
Yeah, that's part of the hard thing too. I mean, for some players there won't be much footage. For most of them, you're only dealing with the ESPN coverage leading up to the final table, which is might only be a few hands for each player. But in some cases, you can find footage of some of the players who who are the professional, you know, more professional players who have been in other events. Like, for example, like in 2013, Ryan Reese, you know, who ended up winning, there was a 9 hour stretch of footage from a tournament he'd gotten like first or second in from Foxwoods or something, and they had it online. You know, stuff like that you can find for some of the players, not all of them. But then it's also a case like those are also sometimes the best players that you're least likely to find something on. So that's also the challenge. Like, yeah, it's definitely not an easy task to do that. And when I work with the two World Series players that I worked with, you know, we all went into it, you know, knowing that it was unlikely that I would find something really game changing. It was more just like, let's cover our bases, and you know, there's a lot of money at stake, so let's cover our bases and look for something.
Did you consider contacting ESPN and seeing if they would, you know, sell you the outtake footage that wasn't on the air?
I actually know somebody who's a producer on producing that footage, and he said it would be very unlikely that anybody would let me do that because they like to keep that really secret, and then it's also, you know, also just respect for the players thing to not have that out there. So, you know,
that'd be really valuable.
Yeah. I mean, trust me, I'd love to bribe an ESPN producer to give me that.
Do you think you found anything that was useful to these players that helped them in the November 9 event itself?
Yeah, I have a few. I have a couple testimonials from both of the guys I worked with on that, and you know, they both said something similar. It was like theoretically it could have paid off, but in the way it played out, it didn't, and that's to be expected because, you know, like I said, it's, you go into it, even if you find something that you think is valuable, it may not show up at all. There may not, and first of all, there's not much post flop play. You know, in the final table, it's a lot of, you know, raises and re-raises pre-flop, and most of the hands end there. So, you know, a lot of the tells, even if you think you have a pattern, it's unlikely that it's going to come up enough where, you know, the person I've worked with is going to be in that situation where it'll be useful. But, yeah, so they both said something similar, which I wasn't surprised at, where it was like it could have been useful if things had played out differently. But the way it played out was not useful. But it was also valuable for them too, even apart from tells, because one of the things I do is assemble footage, you know, to study the footage, and they're looking at that footage that I assemble for them and studying it, not just in a behavioral way, but also just, you know, getting a sense of how they're playing too strategically. So it was also, some of the value was in that too, just having the video that I assembled in the hands and doing the research on the players.
During the November 9, each of the 9 guys have a whole bunch of railbirds in the Penn and Teller Theater. So there's some people who are just there for the event, but each guy has his own crew, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Were you part of the crew, and was there anything you could do at the event itself that was useful?
No, I wasn't. Yeah, I wasn't actually on the rail. We actually found it more practical for me to be remote. I was actually in a hotel room with some computer stuff hooked up so I could play back stuff and look at stuff. And it was also best, I think, because it was just determined to be the best option versus me being there and then trying to notice stuff live and, you know, taking notes and not having access to as much computer playback kind of stuff. And then, we had Skype groups going on, so I could Skype, you know, thoughts to his the person I was working for, his team, and then every once in a while they would take a break and look at any thoughts I had, which were not frequent. It was more like if I thought I saw something that was interesting, I would say it, and we had already talked about previous patterns that could be possible, so if I saw something that was related to that, I would bring it up.
So on this year's World Series, if somebody wants to hire you in the November 9, I assume you're available again. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would. I'd be interested in definitely talking about it for sure. I've only done it twice. I did it 2013 and 2015. But yeah, I'm definitely open to it.
So it sounds like it's the odd year. So 2017 would be your time.
Yeah.
All right. Now the book.
Oh wait, did
is
I say?
Dedicated...
Yeah, 2013, 15. Yeah. Right. So 17. That's the year. Yep.
Yeah. Well, that's a long set of data there to get that pattern. But all right. Now the book is dedicated to No Limit Hold'em, and it's broken down three sections. One is pre-flop tells. One is tells on the flop and turn, and the other is tells on the river. So let's take them in order. On the pre-flop tells, what are some of the general principles that you discuss?
Pre-flop, I talk about one of the things I talk about a lot is what I call ostentatious, you know, behavior, attention drawing behavior. And in a lot of cases, pre-flop especially, when somebody acts in unusual ways that are, you know, like slamming chips in aggressively or, you know, reaching for chips before the action gets to them or whatever it is, a lot of these ostentatious behaviors can weaken their range a lot because people with stronger hands are, for one, they're more mentally focused, so they're more likely to be thoughtful in how they act. And also, with the strongest hands, like aces or kings preflop, they don't like to draw attention to themselves, and so for that reason, they're also a little bit more calm and stoic in their behavior. So a lot of the early in a hand, a lot of ostentatious behavior can weaken a player's range. And that's a pretty common pattern for, you know, whether it's somebody who's a caller preflop, non-aggressor, or somebody who's raising preflop. And that can be, sometimes those can be clues to help you, you know, maybe raise somebody off a hand preflop or play the hand more aggressively, things like that.
Now, some of the tells you talked about in that section were due to players looking at their cards before it was their turn to act. And if you were observing what players behind you are doing, that helps you. So my question is, what percentage about would tells go away if players simply didn't look at their cards until it was their turn?
Well, that's there's positives and negatives to looking at your cards early or later. I actually look early because one of the negatives to looking later, in my opinion, is if you look when the turn gets to you, you don't have as much time to think about the situation or your hand, and you're also kind of put on the spot where people are most likely to be noticing you at that spot, whereas if you look earlier, nobody's really paying attention to you. So I think as long as, you know, I think it's good to look early. It also helps you formulate a little bit of a plot and let you know if you're even going to be interested in playing and helps heighten your awareness. But I think it's okay to look early as long as you are aware of, like, some of the things you could theoretically be giving away behavior-wise. You know, yeah, like you said, like, I talk about some tells that involved, you know, kind of defensive tells from somebody who's, you know, who looks at their cards early and then, like, you know, puts a card holder on their chip on their cards really aggressively, and you know, those kind of tells are, again, ostentatious tells can weaken their range and make it unlikely that they'd be doing that with, you know, aces or kings or something like that because they'd be acting in uninterested ways or something. I think it's good to look at your cards early as long as you have a good idea of the things you could be giving away. And I think, you know, the school of thought kind of varies. I mean, there's definitely super experienced players who you can find very experienced players arguing for both looking early and looking when it's your turn. I've seen examples of both. But I think they have positives and negatives.
You mentioned that looking at the cards for a long time is a sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want me to talk about that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
So that's I wrote about that in the first one too, and I go into a little bit more detail about that. Like, I talk about a tournament I played where I won the tournament, and the guy I was heads up with, it was a small tournament, it wasn't a big one, it was like $100 one or something. But the guy, you know, had the habit of staring at his cards for a couple seconds, his whole cards for a couple seconds when he was, you know, weak or medium strength pre-flop. So, and then, so it was just a clue. If he put his cards down immediately, I would know to be more cautious. And if he looked at his cards for a couple seconds, then I would be much more comfortable about raising him, or three betting him if he had raised, things like that. So, and I think for some players, it's a very valuable clue. And it's just related to, it's mainly just because with strong hands, when people look down at strong hands, they have an instinct to put it down immediately. They don't want to stare at it or draw attention to it. So there's an instinct to just put it down immediately. And then when they have weaker hands, that instinct is not there. So they just end up staring at the cards for a few seconds, you know. And I think that's mainly how the pattern is explained. And so it can help you when you do see it, you know, and ideally you should be, you know, correlating it first, noticing it first to be player true for a specific player before you act on it. But if you do see it happening, showing up for a player, that can be a very valuable clue to, you know, play more aggressively when they're looking for a while pre-flop or slow down if they look immediately, things like that.
Okay, so we talked about pre-flop. The next section was tells on the flop and the turn. How are these different from the pre-flop tells?
The flop is obviously, you know, post-flop's obviously different because, you know, you defined your hand so much on the flop. So it's actually pretty difficult to get a read pre-flop because most people are so ambivalent about their hands. You know, most people don't care whether they get action or not unless they have, you know, unless they have aces or kings, then they really want action, or, you know, unless they're running a huge bluff or something with total garbage. But because hands are so close pre-flop, it's pretty tough to get reads. And then then the flop comes and things get defined a lot more, but there's still a lot of ambiguity because on the flop you can obviously have strong draws that are just as strong as made hands, and you can have very weak made hands that are, you know, you can have an overpair that still feels quite vulnerable. So it's kind of, it can be quite hard to get a read on the flop as well. I'd say most of the strongest reads can happen on the turn and river where the hand's a lot more defined, and so people have more feelings about things one way or the other. So yeah, I grouped it in the flop and turn. It was kind of a rough grouping. Mainly, I wanted to separate the river from the flop and the turn because the river is so, you know, so different because it's action ending and you're either bluffing or you're not bluffing when you bet, things like that. So the flop and the turn section, it's a lot of similar things that I talk about in my first book. Just going into more detail, it talks about somewhat about the ostentatious behavior that I talked about pre-flop, where sometimes you can rule out the strongest hands because a person's acting in a way that they probably wouldn't act in an agitated or ostentatious way if they were at the very top of the range. They'd be more focused, mentally focused. They'd be more stoic, things like that. Then I go into, you know, some verbal things too that are fairly common, like calling for a card, which sometimes people do jokingly, but still they can contain some information. You know, when somebody shouts out like, "Oh, I want an eight" or something. Then there's, let's see, what else we talk about.
So when somebody does that, when they say, "Give me an eight," and the eight hits, is that something to worry about, or is that not something to worry about?
Yeah, it's and I talk about this, that kind of thing in verbal poker tells a lot more detail, but it's basically like, you know, people like to tell the truth a bit, but they don't want to tell the direct truth. So a lot of calls for cards like that are going to be a little bit of truth, but not that much. So for example, like one example I think I give in the book is, somebody calling for, you know, a jack or something, and or they call for a jack on the flop before the turn comes, and the jack comes, and you know, my interpretation was the Jack wasn't the card they actually needed. It was a card that would give them a good draw. So they had, the Jack would have given them an open-ended straight draw, basically, which is quite fitting with how a lot of those kind of, those tells show up. It's like someone is kind of saying it in a joking manner, slightly truthfully, but also, you know, deceptively too. And that's how a lot of those things show up.
So usually when a guy, if a guy says, give me an eight, and the eight hits, usually it's not going to mean he just got a set.
Yeah, exactly. Which is not surprising. Like, yeah, you guys probably would guess that most people aren't going to, you know, with a pocket eight, they're not going to say, give me an eight. Because they don't want to, you know, they don't want to draw, they don't want to draw attention to it. They don't want to kill their action if they do hit. You know, for all those reasons, and most of it'll be done in a playful way. I think it can happen. The less likely it becomes that you know, their hand the less likely it becomes that their hand would hit or would win. The more likely they might do it with like a pair of deuces or something. They might say like, "Give me a deuce," and might actually have deuces just because they know. You know, even, you know, it's obviously such a long shot, and, you know, it's unlikely to, you know, it's less likely to win than a high set, for example. But, you know, most players are not going to do that.
Right. Makes sense.
Or not very often. You would tend to, everybody would tend to recognize that pattern rather quickly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Tells on the river. How are they different?
Yeah, so that was, I broke that up into its own section because river tells are just so much different than the rest of the tells, really. You could even say turn and river could theoretically be a grouping too, because there's a lot of big bets on the turn too. But the river is unique because, you know, there's no more cards coming, and so somebody who makes a big bet is either, you know, almost always has an idea whether they want to call or not. So they, therefore, the behaviors are much more polarized between relaxed and tense. whereas on, you know, on the flop, when somebody makes a big bet, they may be kind of ambivalent because they might still hit a draw or something, you know. So by the river, though, it's much more polarized, which makes those kind of reads more possible. And that's why, like, a lot of the tells early in the earlier sections are about non-aggressors and kind of like tells of laziness, you know, somebody just not really being focused and kind of giving information away, like, you know, calling for a card is a good example. Just things like that where people are just kind of leaking a little bit of information and not really caring that much. And on the river, you know, that doesn't really happen. Players are much more focused. They're much more focused on trying to win the pot. And so it's more about, you know, the tells in that section are more about like, you know, is this guy tense or is he relaxed? You know, those kinds of tells. And, you know, most tells you get from players making big bets are going to be tells of relaxation because, you know, it's pretty easy sometimes to tell when somebody does something unusual that it would be very unlikely for them to do if they were bluffing, you know, whereas it can be quite hard to get a tell of weakness from a player making a big bet just because most people just act stoic in general when they're making big bets. So somebody who's bluffing kind of acts in the same way, the same stoic way, whereas like relaxed tells can really stand out as, you know, and you can be like, well, that guy would definitely, you know, not do that if he were bluffing. He would just be, you know, too nervous and wouldn't want to act in such a weird way. So in many cases, in many ways, it actually is kind of a reverse from what I talked about pre-flop, where the ostentatious tells are make weak hands more likely. It actually becomes, you know, when we're talking about the players making big bets, ostentatious or weird things make relaxation more likely. So it's kind of reversed, which is one of the major kind of themes I talk about in the book. You know, I talk about that throughout, where drawing attention to the fact that these are very different situations. You know, somebody who's doing something early in a hand, you know, can have very different motivations than somebody making a big bet later in the hand. Like, I'll give you one example. A player who raises preflop with pocket aces usually doesn't want to scare anybody away and is much more stoic and focused because, above all, he's worried about, wanting to get his money's worth on this hand, getting a big hand. And so he acts in, inconspicuous ways and in calm ways. Whereas, like, take a player with the nuts on the river, who makes a big bet. He may just be really relaxed because the pot's already big and just, wants to cut loose and doesn't really care because either whatever he does, he's going to be assured of a big win. So he can act in relaxed and ostentatious ways, whereas that's not very common for somebody early in the hand who has a big hand. So that's one of the major themes I talk about in the book.
In general, in the whole subject of poker tells, is it more important to not be giving off tells yourself or to be good at reading other people's tells? Which is more important?
I think it can vary. I think it can vary based on how, it's a lot about how skilled your opposition is. Because I think, if you're playing with people who aren't very good, then it'll be more important to read their tells. But if you're playing with people who are pretty skilled and know a bit about reading tells, then it's much more important to hide your own tells. And, so I think that distinction is pretty valuable.
Yeah, my experience with low-limit games is almost all the players are totally oblivious. I mean, they're just
right.
Not trying to pick up on tells at all.
Right. Yeah. So in that case, it would be you'd be better to focus on reading other people than hiding your own. Because that's definitely my experience. Like even at pretty high stakes games, I think most people aren't really paying attention to that kind of stuff.
What about when a player on the river says things like you know you're going to call, or you have to call, or those kind of things.
Right. I think, I break it down in my book, Verbal Poker Tells. The general concept is that if someone's implying that you, have to call. Yeah, I think I said in Verbal Poker Tells that it was basically the opposite of what the strength that they were that they're ascribing to their opponent. So if a guy bets and says you have to call, he's more likely to be bluffing if he says. It can vary a lot. I don't want to speak off the cuff because I wrote a good amount about it.
Yeah.
I can't remember, but I would say mostly as a general rule. Those players will be relaxed, due to them talking at all. But if a player is bluffing, he will say something that ascribes value to an opponent and say something like you have to call. Like that makes it a bit more likely he's bluffing. But I think overall, people who say things like that, bettors who say things like that, are more likely to be relaxed because of the fact that they're talking at all. When a bettor says something about an opponent being strong, like you have to call, or I know you've got a big hand, that does make him more likely to be bluffing because he's basically trying to imply I'm comfortable even though I think you have a big hand, right? That's something that shows up a lot where a bluffer will say something that implies that their opponent has something that they're going to call with, whether it's, I know you're going to call this, or I know you're slow playing me with the nuts or something, things like that. So those can be little clues, but it does vary a lot. I don't want to just say it's one or the other.
You had a hand in the book this was pre-flop, where I think you said to your opponent, you have to call, and the dealer, I think, chastised you for telling you not to try to influence the hand. Do you want to go through that? I'm trying to remember what that was.
Yeah, I was just joking around. It's kind of a weird situation because in Portland, the cash games are technically tournaments. So most cash games nobody would have cared that I said that, but because in Portland, they're technically run as tournaments, and then they cash out every hour. It's kind of weird. So that was the only reason he chastised me. Do you want me to go into the details?
It was interesting. I thought the tells involved in the hand based on the table talk.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was an interesting one. And, you know, it was interesting because it was mainly interesting because I played with the person involved, you know, so much that I had a good idea of what they were capable of and weren't capable of verbally. So that was why the tell was so, you know, was so meaningful to me. So basically it involved me, it was a 1-2 game, but it had a straddle. So it was a $5, 1-2-5. The opponent had straddle on the button. I was in the small blind with jacks. We both had $300. I think we just sat down. So it was $5 to me in the small blind with jacks, and I made it 20. And then somebody called. They got back to the straddler, the main opponent, and he made it 60, I think. And then he said, so he made a couple small statements, like, you know, kind of induced by me saying something. So I said something like, oh, you got to raise now or something, joking around. And then he raised, and I think he said something like, somebody said, oh, see, that's what you get if when you say something like that. And then he said, the raiser said, oh, that's not why I raised. You know, basically implying I didn't raise because he said something. I raised because I have a hand, right? And so that's kind of tying in with what I was talking about, where he's implying, it's something different, but he's implying strength about his hand. And so the conclusion was, if he had aces or kings, would he really be doing that? And based on my history with him and how I know he's not really verbally tricky, I thought it would be very unlikely he would be doing that with aces or kings, and he wouldn't make that statement. He wouldn't want to accidentally discourage action, right? So that made me very confident, you know, raising with my jacks, thinking he probably had ace king, maybe queens, but in any case, I mean, aces or kings, very unlikely in my opinion, and made it much more likely he had ace king. That was how that hand went down, and he had ace.
Yeah.
All right, we're talking to Zachary Elwood about his new book called Exploiting Poker Tells. We're going to take a few minutes to talk about our sponsors, and then we have some more questions for Zach, including when will this book be available, how do you get it, and what kind of videos are available on his website. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. In January, from Sundays through Wednesdays, 3 a.m. to 3 a.m., there's the $500,000 spin to win promotion. 500 points earned on a slot machine or 2,000 points earned on a video poker machine earns you one spin. You may spin up to four times a day. Spins are either free play from $10 to $100 or they're points. 2,500 points through 100,000 points, which means $750 in value to $300 in value. All prizes are downloaded directly to your machine. You must play off the free play within 2 weeks or it evaporates. First week, the promotions came about 0.6%. The second week, it was higher. That's a rather small sample, but it was higher. So it's only $1,000 coin in, but an extra 0.6 or 0.7% is a good deal. Double points next Monday, Martin Luther King Day, midnight to midnight. No limits. The first 3 hours of Martin Luther King Day will be the Sunday day, insofar as the spin to win promotion goes, but the Monday day, insofar as whether or not it is double points. The next 10-week semester of free video poker classes will begin in a couple weeks on Wednesdays, January 25th at noon in the Silverado Lounge. This lounge is immediately outside of Don Vito's restaurant. First class is Jacks or Better. The complete schedule of classes may be found on bobdancer.com. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. The game of the week is Super Draw 6-Card Poker. This is a 10 coins per line game where you're dealt 5 cards. Choose the card you want, and then you draw. But on the draw, you get a 6th card on every line in addition to whatever card you need to replace the ones you threw away. They're the normal pay schedule categories plus some extra ones. Namely, a 6-card Royal Flush, which is ace through 9 suited, gets you 8,000 coins. 6-card Straight Flush, 4 of a kind plus a pair. 6-card Flush, 6-card Straight, 3 pair, and 2 3 of a kind. There's no commercially available software to let you analyze this game so far. So those of you who are capable of creating your own have a big advantage over the rest of us. All right, let's go back to Zach Elwood on his talking about his book, Exploiting Poker Tells. All right, now you sent Richard and me advanced copies of this book, for which we thank you. And although you did say something about we had to put up our firstborn sons as security against us sharing any of the book before the show. Now, I have and no sons, so I still Richard put up both of his. Now, so I thank Richard for that. Now, when will the book be available for purchase?
I'm hoping it will be available beginning of or mid-February. I'm putting the final touches on it now and hope to get it out to the printer beginning of February to be ready mid-February.
And so I assume it will be printed copies and electronic copies of various sorts or just print?
Yeah, it'll be print and ebook. I'll have it'll be available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the ebook will be available at first, at least on my site, readingpokertells.com. But if you want paperbacks, it'll be on Amazon. Around February, middle of February.
Now, what can people find on your website, readingpokertells.com?
I've got a blog on there. I've got my books, those products. Yeah, that's pretty much it. And then I have a link to my readingpokertells.video site where I've got my video series. But yeah, I've got a bunch of blogs and book reviews and stuff on in my blog area at readingpokertells.com.
All right. How much of that site is a free site and how much of it is there a paywall for some of the videos or anything?
Oh, the readingpokertells.video costs money, the series, and you can purchase a lifetime subscription, which I'll keep adding to. There's about, there's 22 10 to 15 minute videos on there right now, analyzing cash games and tournaments. And then I have if you want to get a sense of the kind of videos I make, you can check out my YouTube channel, which is free, obviously. It's just, if you search Reading Poker Tells on YouTube, you can find it. And a lot of people like those videos a lot. The ones on my readingpokertells.video series are interesting because they use a lot of the same players. I use footage from a Chicago area game, actually, Windy City Poker, and they videotape their games, tournaments, and cash games, and I used a lot of footage from that game, which is kind of interesting because it gives me a chance to build up reads on some players and stuff like that.
Yeah, I would think it'd make you want to go to Chicago to play.
Yeah, there's some good games in Chicago. I'd say the main downside is the rake is pretty large because of it. They're technically have to be run as charity events, and so they give a lot to charity. But yeah, which is good, but it also cuts into the rake.
Well, they do have casinos with poker in Chicago and just over the border in Indiana.
Yeah, just over. Yeah, I think they're just right outside of town. That's right. Yeah, the ones I do the video for are actually in Chicago, so they are technically charity run. Yeah, but they have casinos. Yeah, not in driving distance, right?
Yeah, Yeah.
One of our more entertaining guests who comes on periodically is Lyman. And
oh, yeah.
He has a whole bunch of videos on Live at the Bike of thousands and thousands of videos. I would think if you wanted videos of poker players with potential tells, that would be a wonderful site to go to as a source of tapes.
Yeah, for sure. Right. Those guys are great. Yeah, Live at the Bike is good stuff. I didn't know you'd had Lyman on before. Yeah, I don't know if you heard, he got kicked off of Twitter, unfortunately.
Kicked off of Twitter? How do you do that?
I guess he did.
I'm guessing he was too colorful.
Yeah, and he had a lot of people, some people ganged up on him to report him, I guess. That's what I heard.
Huh. It's funny because I follow him on Twitter. I didn't realize he was gone. So
I just learned about it a few days ago. I was kind of shocked. Yeah, too bad. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sure he can always get back on under another, you know, another email address or whatever.
Well,
yeah,
he's pretty distinctive.
He said he's kind of done with it. I talked to him and he said he was kind of done. With Twitter, he was too angry about it, or thought it was stupid to get back on or whatever.
All right, so thank you, Zachary Elwood. Richard, how do people get in touch with us?
First of all, we encourage your questions. You can send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or post them on our Facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge on our site there, or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. You can get the show delivered to you automatically every week. You can sign up to do that at gamblingwithanedge.com or iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, wherever you normally get your podcasts. And you can find an archive of all the old episodes at bobdancer.com.
All right. Thank you, Zachary Elwood. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.